through the field. Well, I mean,
what you're hearing live is the sound of one of the world's biggest science fiction and fantasy conventions. It happens every year, and this year Worldcon has come to the Kansas City Convention Center. Today we're talking about science fiction and how it wrestles with questions of identity and race and gender. And there's no better place to start that conversation than down at Bartle Hall, where we sent KCUR's senior nerd correspondents Cody Newell and Mike Russo. Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Brian.
Good to hear your voices. So let's start with this. What in the world is Worldcon?
Well, Brian, I was working on that for you, and I think that it's a little bit different than most comic cons. Would you say, Cody?
Yeah, for sure. I think the vibe here is much more spacey, I would say.
These are the people that you want on your Scholar Bowl team, for sure.
For sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
As we walked up, we got a little sneak peek of the floor. There was a gigantic astronaut blow up. Just, I mean, it must have been, 40, 50 feet tall.
An inflatable astronaut?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And a lava pit?
A lava pit with a massive volcano.
And somebody cosplaying from Labyrinth, I think.
Oh, really?
Right? Yes.
I didn't see that person.
Yeah. So there's lots of like Renaissance things going on here, Star Wars. But we have a little bit of an older age, right? Because these are people that are reading longer, big books.
For sure. Yeah, I think it's a different vibe than, say, Comic-Con or Planet Comic-Con, where, you know, you see, obviously there are some younger people here, but I think this seems like people who have been invested in this for a really long time, right? And are really into science fiction, and I think for good reason, right?
Yeah, exactly. There isn't hordes of people trampling over each other for the Transformer bobblehead.
Right.
I saw that this is like the 74th annual one of these, so this has been going on for a while. Any idea how many people attend this thing?
Well, I think the estimate that we got was about 5,000 to 7,000 throughout the week, and that seems, I mean, that's a fair bit of people.
Yeah, totally. And we actually have it, Worldcon is here, right? And now we actually have Juan San Miguel here with us. And Juan, when was the last time that we actually had a Worldcon in Kansas City?
In 1976, 40 years ago.
Okay. So, yeah, so Brian, that answers your question a little bit also.
Tell us more about Juan. What does he have to tell us?
So Juan is an engineer, but he's been volunteering for how long, Juan?
I've been volunteering probably since 1994 at the convention.
Okay. And so we call him our enthusiastic volunteer, and he's definitely sold on Worldcon. Why do people need to know about Worldcon, Juan?
It's a celebration of the science fiction genre. I mean, by the bringing of guests who have had long careers, successful careers. Also, the giving of the Hugos, which is a celebration of the best works of the year and hopefully will encourage people to read. I mean, when I was starting to read science fiction, I went through the old Hugo lists and read some of those stories. Now, some of those stories don't date as well. Some people might not get the same thing out of them, but it's a good building block. I'm pretty sure that film enthusiasts would probably use the Oscars as a guide of, like, looking for films.
Cool, absolutely.
Yeah, these are kind of the sort of thing where if you get a Hugo, it could change your career.
Yes, I mean, there was one person who won a Hugo, Cameron Hurley. She posted in her blog that she got a bigger advance for just winning a nonfiction Hugo for an essay that she wrote 2 years ago.
Wow.
Actually, 3 years ago now.
And is it something that publishers kind of look at for maybe the second book if they win a Hugo for sales?
It probably helps with promotion. I remember Eric Flynn saying... It definitely helps with foreign sales because it helps foreign publishers figure out what's successful. But it can help out a career a great deal.
Mike and Juan, what are you looking forward to the rest of this week in addition to the Hugo Awards?
Well, I usually work Masquerade, so you get to see a lot of great fanish creativity. I mean, making something which sometimes didn't even really exist in the real world exist. Some people base costumes on books. And sometimes they also base costumes on anime. There was an anime cosplayer walking around just yesterday, and I took a quick picture from Fairy Tail.
We've used that word cosplay a few times, costume play, Mike. You give us the one-sentence definition there?
Yeah, forgive me for using the lingo, but yeah, costume play is somebody who is so enthusiastic about the literature or work of art that they're going to represent that in real life in order to show their fandom or appreciation for that work of art. Is that right, Juan?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the thing is, costuming's been going on. I mean, there was a costumer at the first Worldcon in 1939, and he became a big established fan who actually had a whole mansion with artifacts from films and magazines and stuff.
Juan, what was he dressed as in 1939?
He looked kind of like a Flash Gordon character. He kind of had... he looked like somebody you'd see in the throne room of Mongo at the time.
Wow, that's great. I know that there's a lot of conversation about the Hugo Awards. They're anticipated every year. But Cody, I understand that you have someone there who knows a lot about the Hugo Awards and this year's nominees.
Yeah, indeed. We have Jason Ahlquist. He's a documentary filmmaker and a lifelong science fiction fan. He's making a documentary called About Tomorrow, The Fight for Our Visions of the Future, that talks about the intersection of politics and in the history of science fiction. So, Jason, tell us a little bit about, just to start off, the Hugo Awards, the best novel nominees. What's going on with those?
Hi, how are you doing? Well, this year the Hugo nominees are Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie and The Cinder Spires, The Aeronauts Windlass by Jim Butcher, Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin, Sevenus by Neal Stephenson, and Uprooted by Naomi Novik. I don't know. What did you want to know about any of the...
Well, so earlier you were talking about how one author in particular has kind of come into this controversy, and that's what your documentary is about. So
right.
I wonder if you could kind of just give us an intro into that.
Yeah, well, this controversy sort of had its initial spark in the relation... Well, let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
The controversy started out with the Sad Puppies having a literary disagreement with what would be considered sort of like the mainstream publishing houses.
The Sad Puppies being a group that kind of represents a certain political ideology.
Yeah, in a way, and also that they some literary values as well.
Sure.
So the Sad Puppies were wanting to get more attention for works that focused more on adventure and a little bit less on social explorations and that type of thing.
Sure.
But after the Sad Puppies came in, a year afterwards, Theodore Beale, who goes by the name of Vox Day, he created a splinter group called the Rabid Puppies.
Yeah. Wow, this is all getting very complicated. I guess my question is, Cody and Jason, as you look over what's coming up here at this week's conference, and we're going to talk about this controversy at some length in our show today. But from the perspective of someone who's there awaiting the outcome of these awards, is it something that has a lot of anticipation, or is there a lot of anxiety around this?
I think there's a little bit of both. The thing to remember with Worldcon is you get people of all different types of ideology and stripes. So there are people who agree with one side of the controversy and agree with the other side of the controversy, and there's a whole slew of people that are in the middle. Like you said, it's a very complicated issue.
Well, we will be trying to unpack it as the rest of our show goes on today. No doubt that's what many will be talking about there as well. Hey, thanks to all of you for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Brian. It was a lot of fun.
That was KCUR digital editor Cody Newell and our live events producer Mike Russo reporting live from Bartle Hall. Have fun, you guys. And that brings us to our guests in studio, Anthony Sifai Shu. He's an assistant professor at UMKC in the English department. Welcome to you, Anthony.
Good morning.
And also Christine Taylor Butler. She is a science fiction and children's book author herself. Welcome to you, Christine.
Thank you.
I do want to talk about that Hugo Awards controversy, but first I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about the world of science fiction in general and about how it has been a part of your life. Anthony, what was the first work of science fiction you remember reading?
It was probably iRobot by Asimov. And, you know, I was kind of a latecomer. It was probably when I was 15 or 16. I was
Which makes you a latecomer.
A late bloomer. Absolutely, yeah.
What was it about iRobot that you remember?
I think it was just readily available. It was at my library, and it was actually they had a display 1 month of science fiction works, and I wasn't really interested at the time in fantasy, and so something with robots in it, you know, mm-hmm. 14, 15 years old, it was a perfect fit.
What do you remember about it?
The three laws, and that's about it. But, you know, one thing that's interesting is that I had a chance. I think next year we're going to do a series at the Mid-Continent Library on science fiction. And that was one of the first books I wanted to do. And I hadn't read it, and I don't want to give my age. I'm a little too old, but in quite a long time, decades. But I'm looking forward to going back to it. And so it's just something that I think is part of what we call classic sci-fi, the Golden Age.
Obviously, you've had to become familiar with a lot of different genres. Mm-hmm. What is it about science fiction that has kept you kind of coming back there?
Well, I started off my career working on detective fiction, mystery fiction. And, at some point, I kind of rekindled the interest in science fiction. But also I realized, and I never paid much attention to it going through graduate school, that there's a huge apparatus of literature by practitioners, writers, by scholars, by critics, surrounding science fiction, and it's really compelling stuff. I mean, it's complicated, it's sustainable conversation that I think everyone can engage in, but I think at the same time, it's some of the most urgent literature that we can read, and it produces, not to say movies are just derivative of literature, but it produces a whole kind of set of conversations and communities that are excited about communicating about these issues.
Well, and when we're talking about science fiction and fantasy, we are talking about books, but we're also talking about kind of a whole associated world of media that has often brought those stories to an even wider audience.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, I mean, you can even imagine, I know the Hugos don't have award. I don't think there are major awards that overlap between the science fiction world and, say, the video game world. But what you're starting to see with video games is that some of the hottest properties are science fiction based, and they have been for over 25 years.
Christine, we've had you on the show before, and I remember you telling us about growing up near a library and the world that books opened up to you.
Well, I did, and I had parents who were science fiction geeks, and so I grew up reading like 2001: Space Odyssey and trying to unpack the meaning of the obelisks, and I went to movies. When I was really young, the best thing for me about science fiction, it was a perfect way for me to digest social commentary. Mm-hmm. And the example I would give is the classic Star Trek episode where the two guys are feuding and no one can figure out why. And he says, "Don't you see? He's black on the left side. I'm black on the right side." And they go back and their planets are destroyed and they're caught in this nebula and they're going to be fighting to the death for the rest of their life. And you can unpack things going on in the world without getting close to it in a nonfiction kind of way.
So do you remember that having an impression on you as a kid in that sort of social issues sense? Or was it more that you liked the stories and only later you came to sort of appreciate the impact?
I like the story, but it was later that I realized all this was going on in the middle of the civil rights era. And so it's like a lot of science fiction. You read it one way as a kid, you read it a second way as an adult, and you see it's packed and loaded with meaning that you didn't catch the first time, and that makes the reading better the second time.
And why does that happen with science fiction and fantasy in a way that maybe isn't true of, I don't know, biography or historical fiction or something else? What is it about this genre that makes that happen, at least for you?
I think science fiction can be informative, but I also think it's an escape. Sometimes I don't want to be in my real world. I want to imagine us better, or I want to see the commentary where it's dystopian and it's not better. So we can talk about a socialist regime, but we can hide it in a different kind of fabric. So it's a little more digestible and a little less personal. You can kind of see it from a distance. But mostly for me, I wanted to escape. I wanted to see something a little farther out than my own reality.
And if I can ask, why is that? I mean, what was your reality that you wanted to escape from?
Childhood. Civil rights, living in an urban environment. There's no one set thing for it. Because you have suburban kids who are living in idealistic situations who are also unpacking science fiction. I also wanted to say one thing. It's a school day. Mm-hmm. So if you go down to Bartle Hall now, you're going to see older people. But mm-hmm. It's a school day. So in the evening, you'll start to see families come out. And over the weekend, you'll see families come out. It's a big tent. And it's a big tent I wish I knew existed 40 years ago.
Well, I do want to ask, too. I mean, you were growing up as a child, and there's a world that all children want to escape from, right? But you identify, I think it's fair to say, as an African-American, right? Uh-huh. Did being a person of color cause you to read these science fiction stories differently?
I'm a math and science geek, so that was probably part of the interest. But also, there are things you don't really have the capacity to articulate. So there's a joke that Richard Pryor did once that said, did you notice there's never any black people in science fiction? That's because nobody plans for us being around that long. And Star Trek kind of broke that mold in a way that, that other shows didn't. And so I think there's kind of a subconscious desire to see yourself in a global setting. And back then you had to translate. But I wanted to see something more than my backyard in Cleveland.
Anthony, as an English professor, you focus on ethnic and cultural studies, I understand.
That's right.
Take us back. What has been the relationship between issues of race and identity and science fiction as the genre has evolved?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting in the remote that you started with. There was, talking about the sad puppies, there seemed to be this desire to kind of take the political and separate it out from the aesthetic. And I think one thing that's really interesting is that they've always been combined. Mm-hmm. And we always talk about that in, you know, the classes we teach and the conversations we have. So I remember one of the early science fiction texts I read was Edgar Rice Burroughs' Princess of Mars, right? You know, the guy who wrote Tarzan. And, you know, one thing that I thought about was not necessarily about how great this swashbuckling adventure was, but, you know, my father's from Hong Kong. I grew up in a context where I was really used to talking about issues of colonialism. The book was about colonialism for me. And so that, for me, when I read it at a young age, was really intriguing. And it led me to start thinking about different ways you could read science fiction. At the same time, you know, there's a large movement within science fiction that's been around, well, since the 19th century, but I think it gets formalized a little bit, you know, later in the 20th century, called Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And right now we have kind of a burgeoning field of ethnofuturism, trying to talk about writings by people of people of color of various ethnicities and races that have been published over time. But we have some, you know, extremely famous African-American writers, Samuel Delaney, probably the most famous is Octavia Butler, who won MacArthur Genius Grant, I believe, who passed away almost 10 years ago. So, I mean, there's a long sustained tradition of writers of color, you know, participating in the genre and actually finding, you know, fertile ground in terms of exploring the kinds of issues and conversations that y'all were just talking about.
And has the movement of including more writers of color in the broader community mm-hmm. been just about who the authors are, or mm-hmm. does it also get into the evolution of the subject matter of the genre? Or has that been changing for at the same rate, or did that start sooner, or has that come later?
Well, it's hard to say, because what I think one distinction you want to make is that there is a mainstream publishing industry. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm thinking back to, I think, Sherry Thomas, maybe about 10, 15 years ago, put out a collection anthology called Dark Matter, where she actually had a science fiction story by W.B. Du Bois called The Comet. And so what was striking to me is that this isn't necessarily these aren't necessarily sets of pieces of writing that are necessarily just about, let's say, race as a topic, but that the identities of the writers are absolutely central, and they have been over time. The problem with the mainstream publishing industry is that, you know, there are certain considerations that they make in terms of what they're interested in, what markets they want to serve. I think over time, I mentioned Octavia Butler before, but writers like Nalo Hopkinson as well have really opened up markets. So I think it's been imperative for these publishers to do this. But, yeah. You know, subject wise, you know, it's not necessarily just about, you know, the writers and who they are. I think that certainly informs you know, the conversations that they want to pursue.
Yeah, I think we talked about this yesterday, which is what's happening is we have a lot of publishers who are publishing based on their own cultural rhythms. So they recognize something that resonates with them. And, you know, publishing is really odd because it is sometimes one of the only industries that's a little removed from its target audience. And you look at how the demographics are changing. So now the big buzzword is diversity. And it's making people nervous. And part of the reason I think it's making people nervous is publishers are now jumping on this bandwagon for diversity. So they want something that is clearly identified as black. You know, I want it to be as diverse as it can be in terms of what I perceive, you know, Asian or black life is like. And I think that's part of the pushback, is sometimes science fiction has people of different cultures and ethnicities. There's nothing to do with that. That's not that's part of their identity, but it's still a story about human life and human condition.
Which brings us to the controversy that we mentioned in that conversation at the start of the show about these Hugo Awards. And you've already come in wearing your credential for WorldCon, Christine. Let me ask you both, how important are these Hugo Awards? How prestigious, how important are they that they would be a matter of controversy?
Okay, you want me to say they're not?
Say whatever is true.
No, think about this. They are. In the same way the nebulas are really important. This
kind
is
kind of the two biggies in the world.
Those are the two biggies, yeah. and at least, in my atmosphere, what you have is books there and short stories and media that's voted on by fans. People who really love the genre are voted on by fans. And I think the problem with the controversy is it became possible to game the system. So it wasn't just about this is the best literature. But what you can do is you can buy a supporting membership for Worldcon that says, I'm supporting you for, $50, but I'm not planning to attend. So you're not paying the full rate. But it gives you voting rights. And so it is possible to get a whole posse of people who are upset about something to buy voting memberships who don't intend to show up so they can swamp a nomination. And really it comes down to, I think, a kind of angst about change. I think people are slow to change and not realize it. We're not always writing a book about an Asian person or a Black person. We're writing a book about someone's stuck on a planet trying to get off.
And let's, what is it that folks were angry about? We heard mention of this group called the Sad Puppies. This group that had a problem with the way they saw Hugo Awards being voted over the course of a few years. What were they upset about, Anthony?
Yeah, I think in the introduction, one person was mentioned, Box Daly, and he seems to be one of the major voices here. People that are interested in exploring issues of race, gender, sexuality as part of the backdrop, mm-hmm. or even as the main topic of their science fiction works, are often labeled, and those that are interested in those works are often labeled by the Sad Puppies, and I think there's another group called the Rabid Puppies.
Who are even angrier.
That's right. That's right. They're referred to as SJWs, right? Social Justice Warriors. I mean, what's really interesting about it, from a cultural studies point of view, is that this is something, in some ways it aligns with a kind of white resentment politics. There's the rise in the 80s of movements against what's called political correctness. That was the centerpiece early on of Donald Trump's campaign. It's related to what Christine was talking about. Societies change and different topics emerge. And so in a lot of ways, I think what the Sad Puppies represent and what they want to advance is perhaps a return to a kind of literature that perhaps is, it's an older form, it's mm-hmm. an older focus, it's more traditional. And some could say, one would argue maybe that it may be passé to approach these pieces of literature as such. So
can you give me an example of a piece of work that they would regard as sort of this politically correct progressive movement, and then a piece of work that would be more satisfactory to the Sad Puppies?
Yeah, I don't think you have to reach very far to find a work that they don't like. Let's just use an example from an author we already talked about. Let's say Octavia Butler's Bloodchild, her collection of short stories, right, which is really focused on issues of redefining relationships between, in this case, mostly Asian American, African American characters and aliens. And so the focus of that, or those works, really, are to question kind of the terms and conditions that we set in terms of our relationships in the present day, but in an experimental way, attempting to imagine kind of an intellectual, philosophical, emotional negotiation that the character goes through, and so the reader takes some value from that.
Which advanced as what some saw as a more social justice oriented sort of way of thinking.
Yeah, for sure.
So what would be the alternative? I guess what is this more traditional, quote unquote, traditional sort of work?
It's a good question, right? In other words, that a traditional work would be, there have been discussions that I've read that where people that are either sympathetic to or within the organization, the Sad Puppies, refer to things like a return to swashbuckling adventures, space operas. And we have a lot of space operas still, right? But at the same time, they've become more diverse in terms of their areas of focus, but also their characters as well. You know, I think it's also a question of not addressing the kinds of issues that have become, you know, for them hot button issues, but for those of us, let's say people of color, women, or, you know, LGBT people, these are everyday issues that, you know, we're really interested in reading about and actually exploring.
Well, I mean, it leads me to ask, Christine, is this really about science fiction and fantasy at all, or is this just a projection of sort of a current political and cultural debate into yet another segment of the literary world?
I think it's a media-wide problem. You know, you've got Oscar so white, and oh, wait, we've got another slave story we can put out. There's our diversity. I think his mention of Trump is a really good one, and not to make this about politics, but I think there's been this undercurrent of anger about the world changing. And instead of seeing this as a big tent, I compare it to a sandbox where, you know, I used to have all the toys and you can't come in my sandbox and share my toys. And we don't have civil conversations about it anymore. We have blog wars. I see that going on in children's publishing. You see that going on in gaming. People want to kind of differentiate what's going on, and I don't think that's healthy. You can be a gamer and come to Worldcon because there's a whole section for digital games and board games. It's such a big tent, and yet I think there's a, I'm just going to say there's a maturity issue that says, I don't want to share. And at some point, the world's changing.
Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue to talk about how the world's changing. I invite you to join this discussion of identity in science fiction and fantasy. Why do you read sci-fi? Does race or gender factor into it? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. The 74th World Science Fiction Convention is in town. Thousands are expected at Bartle Hall for the next few days. Joining us to talk not only about Worldcon, but about the broader world of science fiction and the way it wrestles with issues of race and gender and identity are Anthony Cifai Shu, professor at UMKC, and Christine Taylor Butler, who writes science fiction and children's books and is a parent as well.
I am.
It's been 40 years, as one of our guests said at the top of the show, since the event was last in Kansas City, but having it twice does put it in a pretty select group of cities, mostly larger ones. I'm curious, is Kansas City a hotbed of science fiction writing and fandom?
Yes, we are. The local science fiction, CACSFIS, it's their initials, is how we pronounce it. I discovered them last year, but they just celebrated their 45th anniversary. They meet every single month over at the Writer's Place. And they were responsible for all of the campaigning that happens to get it to come back to Kansas City. So they have been working and going to international locations and cons around the world to get people to vote to put it in Kansas City.
I read a pretty humorous little essay by George R.R. Martin, who of course is known for Game of Thrones, and will be joining up to date in the next hour here on KCUR about losing and not winning a Hugo Award back the last time the conference was here in Kansas City. Anthony and Christine, we've been talking about the way science fiction and fantasy media have sort of challenged conventions and offered an alternative vision of reality for people to escape to. I'm curious for something that really challenged your own perceptions of reality, that made you think about the world differently. Anthony, what's a good example of that, either recently or a long time ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think recently, because I'm thinking about it because I'm actually teaching it for the semester that starts next week, which I'm still preparing for, is Charles Yu's novel, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. And I think it's a really interesting text. I just published an article a little bit earlier this year on it that approaches the immigrant experience from a science fiction angle. And what it tries to do, actually, it's a really funny book. It's a book within a book. It's a book that, you know, a lot of people, I think, would refer to as postmodern in terms of its techniques and its strategies. But one thing I think it does really productively is initiate a conversation about immigration that's not based on necessarily a conversation around assimilation, a conversation about making do in one society, but trying to understand how society may be organized in different ways that we don't yet perceive. So, for example, there are different senses of time that the characters experience. So, for example, a first-generation immigrant experiences time different than their second-generation child. But at the same time, they live in an imperfect, you would call an imperfect science fictional universe, as opposed to, let's say, the middle class or the upper class who live in a totally science fictional universe. So in some ways, there are certain segments of society that have access to all the benefits, all the wonderful things that come with a science fictional universe. And there are those that may not yet have access and actually have organized their lives around not having that access.
And yet, even as you described that, I wasn't sure whether you were talking about the book or about reality in a culture where some experience time one way and some a different way. Some experience access to resources one way and some different.
You know, and this is a really old literary idea. It's from the early 20th century, the Russian formalists. They had this idea of it was originally written about poetry. It was Viktor Shklovsky had this idea of literature or poetry engaging in a process of what he called defamiliarization, right? In other words, that literature attempts to put a barrier or a wall between you and what you perceive, right, and present it anew in a way that really challenges you to rethink what you're seeing and perceiving. So in that way, that interface with the literature forces you to change how you think about things, how you consider things, how you define things.
But in a way, you wouldn't have responded so positively if you'd been just directly confronted with it, someone just telling it to you. Christine, is there an example that had a direct impact on you?
Too many to count, so I'll consolidate them and say I was and still am a big fan of the old Twilight Zone and Outer Limits.
Why?
They were dark. I grew up in a time when women were supposed to get married. You know, you're not supposed to be an engineer. You're not supposed to be good at math. And so I was living in the library pretty much, you know, on my weekends. And then I was watching Twilight Zone and Outer Limits and thinking about space and invention, and had a middle grade math teacher said, you know, you should go to MIT. And the issue with MIT is not about what's there. MIT is about what's not there. And so it's kind of a sci-fi college of its own. And writing is that for me now, is how to synthesize something out of nothing and spark some other kid's imagination. So I had a lot of influences. I don't know that I can narrow it down to one.
Well, I mean, let me ask you about your journey as a writer. How difficult was it for you to get published?
Pretty damn impossible.
I mean, it took a while.
It took a long time. And I took a side trip writing for children's educational market for publishers like Scholastic, which is my largest publisher, because I met a nerdy editor who said, you know what, you've got this degree, why don't you write nonfiction? I was like, no, I'm writing science fiction. And she's now my editor on the series because she left Scholastic and said, let's talk about that, because I get how much science you're putting into that science fiction. And it took a while to find someone who appreciated what I was trying to do, because science fiction is still considered a genre. It's not literary. It's kind of out there on the fringe.
And do you think that the delay, the difficulty in getting published had anything to do with your race or your gender?
Yeah, part of it did, really. You know, I've told this story before, and I'm calling you out, Random House. I'm calling you out. I had an editor from Random House who had suggested that I write what was a shorter story into a novel. Years later, another editor at the house had read the first part and loved it and was excited to talk about it. So I flew on my own expense out to a conference where she was appearing and introduced myself and said, let's go do that coffee you talked about. And you could just see her expression change, completely change. Diversity was still not a thing in publishing. And I went to my hotel room and I cried. And my agent said, no, she loves it and she's excited about it. And I said, no, it's dead, because she didn't know I was Black. And my agent said, what difference does that make? And I said, it makes every difference. And sure enough, a couple days later, well, we got a rejection that says, well, it's not quite as good as we thought.
Wow.
Same chapters.
You know, I guess I have to ask, and I mean, the concerns of the so-called sad puppies notwithstanding, is the world of science fiction and fantasy still dominated by, well, white men?
I may not have the same sense that Christine has. I think mainly because I'm not necessarily driven by market forces in terms mm-hmm. of the books I teach. So one thing I'll say is that, you know, from my side of the ledger, that it seems like there are a lot more books that I avoid teaching than the ones that I'm interested in. I think maybe because publishers are still catching up with right. maybe the social reality that's right. out there.
You say you avoid teaching. Why?
Well, I think there are certain things that, you know, for me, it gets a little complicated because I have to figure out, okay, what can sustain a conversation over 2 or 3 weeks? Mm-hmm. You know, what can, you know, an audience of people from 18 to 49 be interested in, and what will they, you know, actively want to write about or research on? So my selection process is a little bit different. At the same time, there are some texts that are a bit thin. There are those texts that are a little bit more traditional in terms mm-hmm. of how they focus on things. So they seem like they could have been written in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. So, you know, the literature that's more urgent, that's more complex, and, you know, that brings up complicated questions, those are the things that I find valuable for my students when I teach. So,
right, you can't find what you can't teach what you can't find. So there's a body of work. You know, we have a whole panel on Afrofuturism, but there's a body of work that's diverse. People are just now discovering Octavia Butler, but she's been around, and N.K. Jemisin. But if you have publishers who will say, yeah, you know, we're going to put this out, but we're not going to market it, and we're not going to promote it, then they go, oh, you know, look, nobody's buying the work, but we are putting millions of dollars into better-known, well-known names. And so perception becomes reality, you know, and we have a lot of people who are trying to address issues of race, issues of culture, and then we have a lot of people who are saying race informs the actions of the characters, but really this is just a good book about a science discovery and everything in between. So I think you're right, publishing is trying to catch up, but part of that is publishing is still heavily controlled by people who are not diverse, so they're buying what they like. And when they buy something from a person of color, the other big issue is they are often changing the voice to something they recognize. And you end up with something that doesn't resonate with the target audience because it's just like everything else they're putting out.
So as we start to wrap this up, I guess I'm curious from both of you if you're hopeful about the future of science fiction and fantasy, both in terms of the world, the diversity of who finds an audience, of who gets published, but also in terms of the content of the literature. Is it moving in a healthy direction, do you think, Anthony?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when Colson Whitehead has Oprah's book club or book of the month, right, with his new, I think it's called Underground Railroad, mm-hmm. You know, Colson Whitehead is someone who kind of straddles the line between science fiction and what we'd call more traditional literary fiction. When he becomes part of the mainstream, is, you know, he's someone that could probably write whatever he wants mm-hmm. to nowadays, right? I'm hopeful for it. I think that there's you know, publishing houses are finding something valuable there.
Christine, are you hopeful for the future of sci-fi?
I actually am. And, you know, I had a weird reaction to my book, which is I have a lot of people saying, you know, I don't normally like science fiction, but I like what you wrote. And I said, well, you know, there's a huge range of science fiction. And you know, some of it can be light and some of it can be fun. But, you know, I would encourage people. I've only found out about Worldcon last year. I would encourage people to come out. It is probably one of the most joyful group of people I've ever met.
And it goes on through this weekend at Bartle Hall. That's Christine Taylor Butler and Anthony Cifi Shu. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks.
When we come back, KCUR Central Standard once more listens in on the Ghost Notes podcast. We'll hear music and conversation with the amazing local bass player Jeff Harshbarger. I'm Brian Ellison. Don't go away.